You all look beautiful out there. I don't know how I look to you, but you're a great crowd. My name is Marguerite Haig. I am an alcoholic. And I have been sober through the grace of God, my sponsor, and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous since February the 28th, 1950. And you know, I'm proud of that record. Life wasn't easy for me when I came into AA, and it wasn't easy when I started drinking and everything. I started drinking at an early age, and I started going around with boys in third grade of school. I was headstrong. I've always been that way. I don't listen to anybody, and I guess I'll always be that way. I'm very self-centered, but I have conquered a lot of that since coming into AA because I have a sponsor that he believes in telling you exactly what he thinks you should do. And I'm the kind that comes right back and tells him, I don't want to do that way. So we argue. But eventually you find out that your sponsor's right and you do it that way. There are so many new expressions in AA since I came in. It's really funny. My mother and dad were separated when I was 4 years old, and we left the country and came to St. Joe to live. And my mother had to work. And I lived with my grandparents, my aunts and uncles. I was just shifted from one place to another, you know. What you all today call a dysfunctional home. That word was not in the dictionary when I came in. It wasn't even thought about. And then you see you have alcoholic children, adult children of alcoholics. I never knew that before when I came in. I did not know what a treatment center was when I came in. Because when we came in, you've got a hotel room and two people sit with you for every 4 hours. The AAs would change people to sit with you until you were dried out, and then they'd try to find you a job. And that's a lot different from what you have today, because you go into treatment for 30 days and then you come out and you still got somebody that you can lean on. You can even go back to spend another 30 days after you've been out 3 weeks. I wanted to put somebody in treatment center here recently. And they said, oh, is he drunk? And I said, no, he's sober. Well, if you'll go out and get him drunk, we can take him. And I thought, well, to hell with you. I'm not going to get him drunk just to get in treatment. And that's what I mean. That guy's sober today now. And he's doing it the hard way on his own, and I'm real proud of him. But to get back to my drinking days, I started early in school, going out with boys, you know. Even in my grade school days, I was a little hellion. I spent the greater part of my school days in the principal's office. She just loved me. Because she knew every time she come out that door, I was going to be sitting in the hall waiting for her. It was really something else. Then when I got into high school, and I became a pep squad leader, and that was good. What you all call different names now, I was there in the early days, and you know we had to wear longer skirts than they do nowadays. They didn't believe in showing everything. And that's what most of your skirts are today. So it was great going to school. And I always wanted to be older than I was, so I'd make my mother let me wear my sister's clothes to school so I could look big. And my sister had one of these, this was in the flapper fanny days, you know. She had one of these tan dresses with flames all coming up all around it, you know. And boy, could you strut in that dress, and the boys would just look at you, know. It was something else. I went to a lot of dances. I went to all the football games and everything. I did not like to stay at home. I still don't. And I'll tell you more about that later. But in high school, I was one of the ringleaders. I got good grades because I lied. I'd tell them that my grandmother died, my uncle was sick, my mother had to go out and leave me alone the night before, and I couldn't study without somebody being there with me, you know. And so then finally she got her a job where I had to be farmed out to some people. And this guy was my own age that was belonged to the son of this lady where I was farmed out to. So we would crawl out the window off of my bedroom, you know, and go out for the night. And we'd be so tired the next morning, and his mother couldn't understand what we'd been doing all night. It was easy. And it was a great time. Then I took 2 years in junior college. Then I decided it was time to get married, that I thought I'd had enough boyfriends going around all the time, you know, get married and have kids. And I said, well, no, I don't want kids right away. But we got married, and every year for the next 2 years in May, I got pregnant. So the next of May, where I would have had my fourth child, I went away for vacation for a whole month. And so help me God, I didn't get pregnant till February of the next year. But all in all, I had four children. I've worked all my life doing something at the other. And then we decided, my husband, after we got married, you know, he was an insurance salesman. And you know what these insurance salesmen are. They go from house to house, and they expect to have a drink when they get home, and they expect to party every night. Well, I told him that I didn't think I could take that kind of a life. There was too much drink in there. And he looked at me straight in the eye, and he said, if you don't want to party with me, there's plenty of others that do. And I said, the hell you say, I'll party. And I did. I got to the point where I could drink him under the table. And I was proud of that feat, you know, being back in those days when you was either a whore or a prostitute or something else if you went in a bar. It didn't make it too easy, but I did it anyway. That was just the headstrong way that I was. Then we decided that we was too close to our parents, we'd move. So we moved out to Arizona, Tucson. And there he got a job on a tractor digging cattle tanks. That was quite the deal back in those days because there wasn't much water and they had to dig these cattle tanks, you know, and fill them and everything. And I got the job as cook on the construction crew. And I have one failing when I was drinking of everything I cooked had to have some wine, whiskey, or something in it, you know. And I kept that construction crew very busy keeping drunk. They didn't know whether their soup was going to have whiskey in it or milk. It was just one of those things that kept going on, you know. So then we got tired of that, and we moved up to Phoenix, Arizona, and he went to work in the orange groves and the cotton fields. And that's when I had my second daughter. I had my first daughter in St. Joe, and that was real easy. I'll have to tell you about my marriage. I better go back a little bit. I got married on Friday and had all four wisdom teeth pulled on Monday. That was my honeymoon, getting my teeth pulled so my husband could take care of me. He took care of me all right. I stayed drunk all the time. And then after we had had this second daughter, we moved to Phoenix, Arizona. I didn't have too much work to do because there was some Mexican people out there, you know, that worked in the cotton fields and the orange grove. They took care of the kids for me, and I just drank. I didn't even clean my house. They cleaned it for me. They were so sorry because I was so frail. Hell, I could have worked rings around all of them. I wasn't frail. I was lazy. But I liked it that way. Then we moved to Boulder City, Nevada, and I got a job as a waitress in the hotel there. And that was during the building of the Boulder Dam is what they used to call it. It's now Hoover Dam. And I want you to know those construction workers, they tip big. And there was a bar right outside of town because you couldn't buy liquor there in Boulder City. It took 9 miles to get out there. And we would take turns on this motorcycle going out there. One day I was so drunk, I got on this motorcycle and I started out for the bar, you know, and I went over the mountain. And I spent the next 6 weeks in the hospital. But it didn't teach me anything. I still like to drink. So after we had this bout there, there was also a prison camp on the other side of us, you know, down there in Boulder City. And they would let these prisoners out on holidays to eat at different places, you know. Well, I had three of them for Thanksgiving one Christmas. One Thanksgiving, one Christmas. I guess you like that deal. What the hell? Anyway, I had decided to make pumpkin pies. And I think I must have got the milk and the whiskey mixed up, because those three guys went back to the barracks so drunk they couldn't even see their hand in front of them. Officer over there looked at me and he said, "What'd you all have for dinner?" And I told him. I said, "Now, I got a little bit of whiskey mixed up in the milk, and maybe that's what's wrong with them." It was. But it just seemed like things happened to me. I didn't have to make them happen. They just did. It was always like that. Then we moved to Boulder City. I mean, from Boulder City into Las Vegas. Then I become a shill there. That was a pretty good job, you know. Pretty good work, too. And I liked it. Because you met a lot of men, even if your husband and the kids was across the road in the house. And it was fun. Because they have bought you a lot of drinks. And you could get just as drunk as you wanted to and still work. And I liked that. So then I decided I was tired of my husband. So I picked up the four kids, got on a bus, and came back to Kansas City. The kids arrived 10 days before I got there. I got off at Albuquerque to get a drink, and the bus went on without me. And there was two real nice truck drivers in there, you know. So they said, "We'll take you home." Well, we went home by way of Texas and back to the East Coast, and then we come back to Kansas City. My folks had the police out looking for me because they didn't know where I was, and neither did I for a while. It was just one of those things that went on like that. But my life was just what I thought was fun. Everything was fun as far as I was concerned. I didn't have any blackouts. I didn't have any hang-ups or anything like that, you know. My kids adored me, you know, and all that. And we left him out there in Boulder City with his folks. They were mean. My in-laws could be very devastating. And my sister-in-law, she was terrible. She gossiped. She told him lies about me. Really, they were true. But I called them lies. And we went on from there. He came back from California to take me and the kids back. And I said, "I don't want you anymore. You're not what I want. And the kids aren't what you want. So you're just going back to California. We're going to stay here." I had an apartment. The kids were going to school. And we was doing fine. I had me a good job. Plenty of money that I could drink. I didn't have a car at the time. But one good thing about my drinking days, I'll let you in on later. But as you got off of the bus from our apartment, which was right across the road, there was a bar. And it was such a temptation to go in there every night when I got off that bus and take a drink, and another one. And my kids had finally come over and get me to go home and cook supper. And as soon as supper was over, I'd come right back to the bar, and I'd close it up. I'd go to work the next day. It was a marvelous life. I really enjoyed it. And had one guy over there that posed as my brother. And we would mooch drinks off of the guys in the bar. And they'd think they was going to get something out of it. And then just as closing time come, he'd say, "Come on, sis, let's go home." And they were so down. Really, it was something else. But I loved life. And I still do. But there came a time when they said, "If you don't start taking better care of your kids, get over this drinking and everything, something's going to happen to you." I said, "No, it won't." And I kept on drinking. And one of the things that I learned early is if you have a car, don't drive it when you're drunk. So I always borrowed the bartender's car. If I wrecked it, it was his insurance that paid for it, not me. It wasn't my fault. He loaned it to me, see? wasn't my fault at all. And life went on like that. And then in January, they decided I should go to AA. My kids was all teenagers in high school that time. So I took me 2-3 drinks, and I went to this meeting of AA's. And I looked around, and I thought, this is a crock of shit. I don't belong here. These people don't understand me. And they didn't. But they begin to. Because into this group that I went was 2 women and 15 men. And in the meantime, I got this divorce from my husband, and he was still back in California. I had no strings attached, see. Just the kids. I was getting too drunk, kind of losing too many pocketbooks and coats and everything, you know, being sent home in taxi cabs. I worked as a call girl for a while. I'll be truthful about that. It was a lot of fun, getting called in the middle of the night, you know, go out and have a party, come home, fine. There was always money attached to that. The money was always good. But I went into this group, and it was real funny. I looked at these men and these 2 women, and this one girl, she was harder looking than I was at that time. And this other, she was a namby-pamby sort of person, you know, she didn't know her own mind. And these 15 men, they looked stern, like, what have we got on our hands now? And I looked at them and I thought, what am I doing here? Well, if I'm going to get sober, I'll get sober. And they got me a big book. And they said, you'll read this. I said, sure I will. And next thing I come to, did you read the big book? Yep. What'd you learn? Nothing. Did you study it? No. You just told me to read it. You didn't say study it. Well, then they give me a 12 by 12. And they said, this is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you will read these, and you will study them. And this is how we live. We abide by each of these, and we take them one at a time. We do not go from 1 to 12. We take them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I said, I don't want to. I said, this does not conform to my way of living. And they just sort of looked at me. And this guy that later became my sponsor, he said, why do you think these don't conform to your way of living? I said, they just don't. It says I can't do things that I do. And he says, well, that is the main point of this program, is for you not to drink and to follow these 12 steps. I said, my life's not unmanageable. He said, yes, it is. I said, no, it isn't. I said, I just drink too much, and I'm in here for you all to show me how to drink sociably. And he said, that's not either why you're in here. And I said, well, what am I in here for? He said, you learned to live your life without liquor. And I said, no way. No way at all was I going to do that. I said, liquor's my life, and I love it. I love the taste of it, and I don't want to get away from it. I just want to learn to drink sociably. He said, what's sociably? And I said, I don't know. I said, just, I guess, drink so you don't get drunk. He said, you will never be a sociable drinker because you're an alcoholic. And I said, what's an alcoholic? He said, it's a drunk that can't drink. And I sort of looked at all of them, you know, and they was looking very solemnly back at me, you know, like they had a new kitten they was going to train. And I could not see that at all. But I decided to try it. And this one girl, she called me up one day and she said, I think I'm going to get drunk. Will you come and sit with me? And I said, I'm not supposed to come alone. Oh, you learned that? I said, yeah, you're supposed to go in twos if you make a 12-step call. She said, well, if you don't come, I'm going to get drunk. So I called my sponsor, and he was busy, and I called somebody else, and they was busy. I thought, oh, to hell with all of them. I'll go by myself. So off I go to take care of this girl. She was drunker than a skunk, and just from the fumes of her breath, I almost got drunk. And then when my sponsor finally got there, he said, did you drink? I said, no, I never touched it. It's her breath that's got me all this smelly. And he said, oh. So I let it go with that, and he took me home, and he told me I was never to make a 12-step call again by myself. I said, okay, but what am I going to do if I can't find anybody to go with me? You stay at home. And I said, me staying at home is a different thing. I don't like to stay at home. He said, well, you just stay there anyway. Also in this group was another guy that I took a liking to. I liked to flirt with him, but I liked to go out with other people too, and he didn't like that. I eventually married him. Just like that, I just married him. We lived together for 4 years, and me being sober and a good housewife, you know, I still didn't like to cook too well. But I became the model housewife, you know. But I'll tell you one thing, that when I was drinking, it took 2/5 of whiskey to clean my house. I started at the front door with 1/5, and by the time I got the kitchen, I was ready for the 2/5, and by the time I mopped myself out of that kitchen, it was gone. And of course, you couldn't walk back across that freshly mopped floor. You had to go over to the bar and sit and wait for it to dry. I liked my life. But after coming into AA, that's where I really learned how to live. I found out that the things that I had done before were childish. And that I had found a new way to live, a new way to write my life all over again. And during the time that I was living with my second husband then, and he had a heart attack and died. And that was one of the first blows that I had in AA after I came in. And I grieved. And I'm not like I am now. Then, I am not like I was then as I am now. Does that make sense to you all? Doesn't to me. But anyway, I grieved, and I did not know that there was a word that you don't grieve, that you just turn it over to God, you know, and you remember all these sayings that you learn in AA. Live and let live, turn it over to God, let him take care of it, you know. Pray one day at a time. I thought that was all a lot of horse shit. And I just did not do it the way they told me to do it. Then after he passed away, I began to think that something was wrong. I was not doing the things that I should be doing and be happy about it. So I took another look at the steps. And as I read them, this... Somebody got to go? I looked second time at it, and it said, your life's unmanageable. So I sit down, and I took a piece of paper, and I read the assets and the liabilities, and I decided, well, maybe my life is a little unmanageable. Even though I've been sober this long, maybe I better take a look at my shortcomings, of which I don't think I have any. I just knew I didn't have. But anyway, I got to working on myself. And then I came to believe that maybe I was insane and that something should be done about it, because I didn't want anybody to take me out to the state hospital and leave me there, even though later on I did start taking AA meetings out there and holding them. And I looked at that. And then the third step, came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. And I thought, well, I have always been a... You know, that was one of the things in my drinking days, that every time I saw a revival tent, I joined that religion. It didn't matter what it was. I was so religious, it hurt. But it wasn't helping any. And so when I married the third time, the preacher said, what religion are you? And I said... I began to tell him all the different ones that I was, you know, and that my daughter had studied Catholicism, and I had studied with her, and then she became a Judaism, and she was married to a Jewish boy, and I said another one started out as a Baptist, Now she's a Christian. The son started out as an Episcopalian. Now he's a Christian. And I said, my youngest one's never had much of a chance of religion, and I think I don't really know what I am. He said, you better be baptized, and then we'll know what you are. So they baptized me a Methodist. I had never studied that before. And that's what I ended up as. And things kept getting better and better, and I kept learning more and more, and I kept doing what people was trying to make me do. It takes a little time for me to catch on. They will tell me something to do, and I have to think about it for a little while, because I don't believe they're telling the truth. And it says honesty is the main part of this program. When I came in here, I didn't believe anybody was honest. I thought they was just selling me a bill of goods. Just like, you know, these car salesmen, they lie to you. I come to find out it wasn't a bill of goods, that it really was something that I needed and I could use. And I started working the steps. I started reading the big book. I went back through it and I studied the big book. Somebody told me that if I would take one paragraph and take the most important word out of that paragraph and see how I could use it to my best advantage, I would know how to absorb the good things in the big book. So I started doing that, and that's how I remained sober. That's why I can be contented today in the way that I am. Then I finally got to the 12th step. That's the step I like best. Of course, the 11th says that I had a spiritual awakening and was going to do different things, you know. See, I still can't tell them verbatim just what they say, but they're all in there somewhere. And I do work them all. Then it said 12-step work would help you. So I started going on a lot of 12-step calls. One of the first calls I ever made was with another girl. I'll never forget it as long as I live, because I was kind of new at this 12-step work, you know, and I didn't know what to expect when we went to this little old motel. This happened to me again a few years later. But this lady wanted to tell us about her husband, and she wanted us to go about 15 miles out in the country and sober him up. And we told her we couldn't do that. She says, well, I want to show you what he done to me. And she got up out of this bed. It was just a little room. One girl was sitting here, and another one was here, and I was here. And she turned her back, and the light hadn't gone on. She had tried to turn the light on so we could see better, but it didn't go on. And just as she threw her gown over her head to show us her backside, what he had done to her, the light came on. I'm telling you, that was the first time I ever got mooned, and I wasn't very proud of it. Wasn't what I was expecting, I'll tell you that. And she never called us back, and she's not sober today. And I don't know what about her husband, but I feel sorry for him. Just don't know what he's doing. But to me, in studying the big book, it has recreated a different person in me, a caring person, a loving person, and someone who's willing to go out of their life, out of their way to help somebody else. I went around to a lot of schools and talked about the AA program. I'm proud to be in it. I can safely say now that I am glad I'm an alcoholic, even though I didn't know what it was when I came in here. But I've learned many definitions of an alcoholic. And the cleanest and the best one is a drunk that can't handle their liquor. And that's exactly what it is. I found out the hard way that I couldn't handle liquor, and the best thing to do was to give it up. I have done that. I live the 12 steps very religiously and very faithfully because I think that they are my life. And without them, I would not have anything. My sponsor always told me that when you go to make a talk, you carry your big book with you because it gives you inspiration. My big book's out there under the table. It's not doing me a bit of good in here, and I wasn't going to read out of it anyway. But it taught me patience. It's taught me tolerance. It's taught me how to tolerate other people. And to recognize their shortcomings, there's some that I had at one time or other, but I don't have them anymore because I work on them continuously. I refuse to let myself get depressed because it's nothing but just letting yourself get down. And then you have to go to the doctor and you have to take medicine, and that's a bunch of crap. There is no way that you need medicine for depression. And there's no way that you have to stay in a depression if you don't want to. This program is a workable program. And if you want to be happy, you have to work it day in and day out, 24 hours a day. You have to work on your shortcomings. You have to know what they are. You have to take your inventory every so often. And don't lie about it to yourself. I've done that for quite a few years, you know. I'd say, my ego's not too big. My self-centeredness, that's a good character. I need that. Selfishness. I'm not selfish to a certain degree. And I could just go down that list, you know, like nobody's business. But I come to find out that I was lying on to myself. And to myself, I have learned that you have to be honest. Honesty is the main part of this program. I was never so mad in all my life as when they took you out. You have to have an honest desire to be in this program. And when they took honesty out of that, I thought they was the biggest damn fools I ever heard of, and I still do. Because honesty with yourself and with your higher power is what keeps you on the AA program being sober all the time, being straight, being good to yourself. There's a lot of people that will say, oh, I lost so-and-so, I just know this, that, and the other. You know what makes me the maddest of anything? Is these people that will put their folks in a convalescent home and never go to see them. And when they die, they're the ones that cry the hardest. And I just want to hit them over the head with a ball bat. Because they don't really mean it. If they had mean it, they would go to the hospital to see their parents. And I can get so mad when I walk into a funeral home to pay my respects. See these people sitting there, oh, he's so good. I don't know why he had to die like that. God, he's a lot better off. With relatives like that, he's a lot better off. And I believe that. And it's just like when my son died, you know. He was, in his senior year of high school, I had let him go back to visit his father in California. Father tried to buy his love by getting him a motorcycle, black jacket, letting him join Hell's Angels. He was killed. And I blame God for that. And for 2 years, I would have nothing to do with God or with religion or anything. And it finally came to me, I figured that God was punishing me for my drinking and the things that I had done that was wrong back in those days. But the bolt of lightning must have struck me or something, because I found that God was doing for me what I was not able to have done for myself. My son was killed in such a way that it was better for him to have died instantly as to gone on with Hell's Angels, and no telling what he would have died of later on. We all know what Hell's Angels were. And it was then that I found God really and truly. In the AA program, I found that he was with me at all times, and I was not getting him credit for the things that he was doing for me, the good things. I have found that God led me into this program to give me a chance at a new life, a new way to live, a new way to take care of my shortcomings and make me something of which I could be proud. I won't say that I wasn't proud of me when I was nasty, but I'm prouder of myself today for what I have become. And it's only through God's help that I'm here. It's only through his wishes that any of us are in the program of AA. Because he's given every one of us a second chance at life that we would not have had otherwise. He's made us see the light of a new beginning. And this new beginning starts every day when we get up. We ask him for help, and we ask him for his will for us, not ours. Because we haven't got sense enough to do it ourselves. And it's through God that we get the will to live and to do. And He gives us the love and the care and the sharing of all the people around us. And it's through Him that we learn how to be a friend to mankind. To be a friend to each other is what we do in this program. And without that friendship, look at you, the people on the street that don't have the friendship of the people like we do here. They're uncomfortable. They're unhappy. They don't have a standard way of life. They don't have meetings where they can find comfort in their sorrows, and when they're sad, they're able to talk about it. They don't have any of that to what we like. We have something that is so unique and precious that we should never let go of it in AA. Alcoholics Anonymous has done for us what millions of other people could not have done. The church did not do it. Your moose did not do it. Your Mo'ila, the Shriners did not do it. Didn't any of them do it. But Alcoholics Anonymous people did. And that's where I say that we are so very, very fortunate that we have had a reawakening, that we have found ourselves now, and that we can go on in life and rebuild and find the happiness that we didn't have before. And that's what I like about this program, is the people in it. There are no strangers. Everyone is a friend to each other. And if you don't make yourself a part of that, you're losing one of the most valuable things on earth, friendship and love of your fellow man. And that's what you've got here. Hang on to it. Nurture it. Make every friend that you can here. And life is a beautiful thing. Thank you.